From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. On this sunny day, we're in the grassy courtyard of a U-shaped apartment complex in Baldwin Hills. That's where Jose Lopez has been happy to live for more than 20 years.
It's very inviting. It's warm. It's like it's giving me a hug. Look at it. It's two arms are reaching out to me. I'm walking in. And I can look to the left, I can look to the right, I can look to the center, and I can see all my neighbors. If they walk out, buenos dias, como estas? How are you doing, right? It's very communal.
Lopez loves this building and the neighbors who share it with him. And now he's about to become a co-owner of it by way of what's called a community land trust. It's an increasingly popular housing model here in L.A., one that aims to keep neighborhoods affordable by letting tenants own the buildings where they live. It's also a radical experiment in what it means to live collectively. And as KCRW's Zoe Matthew explains, new public funding means it's about to get a lot more common right here at home.
It was winter of 2022 when the real estate speculators started descending on Jose Lopez's home. He remembers seeing five luxury cars pull up in front of his 12-unit building, and then out stepped the men in suits.
They were walking through and the salesperson was saying, hey, are you seriously interested? Are you really interested? Give me an idea. And I said, okay, this is going to flip real quick and I've got to do something about it.
He'd been anticipating this day for a while. The building's landlord, a wealthy philanthropist, had recently passed away, leaving the four Baldwin Hills apartment buildings he owned to his alma mater, Boston University. That private Eastern school was now Lopez's landlord. And he worried that if the university sold the four properties, he and more than 100 other tenants in the mostly black and brown community would be displaced from their rent-controlled units. Most pay hundreds of dollars below market rate. And if rent went up, they wouldn't be able to stay in the neighborhood, where a one-bedroom now costs around $2,000 a month. Like Irma Galvez, she's lived next door to Lopez for a decade and makes her living vending corn, ice cream, and other treats nearby.
Everybody knows me because I'm selling in the in the neighborhood. Oh. Yeah, so they know me now. So see, like for me, it's important. This is my house. It's my job. Like it's everything, you know.
So Lopez, Galvez, and their neighbors started organizing. They met with residents of three other buildings Boston University was now selling in L.A., and they searched for ways to stay. That's when they reached out to the Liberty Community Land Trust, a nonprofit that preserves affordable housing in South LA and helps tenants become owners of their homes. Damian Goodman, the organization's founder, says he sprung into action.
We were on the phone with them within 2.5 hours, telling them that we wanted to purchase the buildings, had been working with the tenants for the purpose of preserving their affordability into perpetuity and getting the tenants in a position to own their units collectively.
Now, just 4 months later, Goodman is finalizing a contract to buy those four properties. Once the ink dries, Liberty Community Land Trust will rehab them and then eventually transfer ownership to tenants. It's going to be a big change, says Lopez.
The difficult part is now we are going to have to learn how to be responsible for the building.
But he's confident it'll be worth it.
Rather than having to follow the landlord's rules, we're going to be able to say, hey, what do we want? What are our rules? What does our paradise want to look like? Do we want a fire pit in the middle of the lawn right here? Do we want an avocado tree right here? What do we want? And that's agency, right? That's some autonomy. That's beautiful. Not a lot of people ask poor people, what do they want?
Community land trusts, sometimes called CLTs, can be a little confusing to understand at first. So let me break it down. Basically, they're nonprofits that buy up property and use it for things that benefit the community, like parks, community gardens, or in the case of Jose Lopez's building, affordable housing. When a CLT buys a residential building, it owns the land under that building permanently, promising to keep it affordable. And usually, tenants then get a chance to buy their own units. They'll pay rent into a common fund and form a co-op that collectively makes decisions about things like remodels, community rules, or repairs. It's kind of like a condo conversion, says Goodman. But the goal here isn't profit. It's community building.
Most important word in community land trust is community. And when people see themselves tied to, even when they're able to own some of these properties themselves, but tied to the broader, to the collective, that's when the real power manifests itself.
A group of local community land trusts got a boost several years ago when LA County forked out $14 million to help them buy and rehab 8 different properties across LA. The focus was on saving smaller multifamily apartment buildings. These make up a lot of LA's affordable housing, but they're rapidly being scooped up by speculators. Ann Goodman says preserving them is usually a whole lot cheaper than building new low-income housing from the ground up.
It's the best deal out there. If you want to keep people from being unhoused, you got to keep them in the affordable housing they're in right now.
But while buying a building is easy, if you have the funds, learning to live collectively takes a lot longer.
Often the newer COTs or even the new buildings that we acquire, these are tenants who are also learning these models for the first time, and they're models that are not necessarily taught.
That's Casey Ventura at the Beverly, Vermont Community Land Trust. He's been helping tenants in some of these pilot properties set up their co-ops for the first time.
So it's always, I would say, like a slow process to even begin to imagine that, because I think like oftentimes people because they don't know about housing cooperatives or community land trusts, they've never been able to like visualize what a community control housing and land looks like.
It can sometimes take years for a CLT to transfer a building to its resident owners. And that's because they need to answer some big questions, like how much do people need to pay to have a share in the co-op? And then there are the smaller day-to-day issues, like who is responsible for repairs. For that, Ventura says learning how to navigate conflict is key.
You're going to come into conflict, and that can hold things up. But if you know how to deal with each other conflict, and it makes just like discussing things like, what should we do if someone clogs the pipes and it busts all the pipes? It makes that conversation a lot easier.
In a bright yellow fourplex on Kenmore Avenue in Koreatown, a group of women called the Senoras for Housing has been having these conversations for nearly 2 years now. Since the Beverly, Vermont Community Land Trust acquired their building in 2021, they've been busy outlining the rules for their new co-op and saving up for the future improvements they want to make. Rent is no longer rent. Now it's a monthly carrying charge, says future co-owner Ixchel Hernandez.
That carrying charge is going directly into our building, into any emergencies. If we want to, like, you know, if we want to build something for our community, if we want to do renovations to bring pride into our building.
Future co-owner Alejandra Vaez faced harassment and an eviction attempt from the previous landlord. So stability and ownership really mean a lot to her. She says one of the most important decisions was to make Senoras for Housing a limited equity co-op. That means if members leave, they won't get back more than they paid. And that helps preserve affordability for future residents.
We'll never make profit, really, but it will never leave this community. This building and this land will always be here, and it will never be allowed to be bought out by these rich people that just want to displace us.
The ultimate goal, Vaya says, is to pass the home on to future generations, like 17-year-old Diana Martinez, who has lived here all her life.
It gives me hope for the future, and it gives me a sense of security knowing that my mother, I won't have to worry like about her well-being and whether or not she can pay rent.
The Senoras hope to have full ownership transferred to them before the end of the year. And soon, they'll be a model for many other future co-ops in Los Angeles. And that's because Measure ULA, a city tax measure passed last fall, is expected to funnel millions more dollars into community land trusts in the coming years. So CLTs will be sticking around in LA. And so will Jose Lopez in the Baldwin Hills building.
I don't want to live anywhere else but this place. I want to die here. I'm happy. This is where I want to be.
He says he and his neighbors are excited to get their own co-op started soon and to remain in their homes indefinitely. For KCRW, I'm Zoe Matthew.
Oh. Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. When you're in trouble, you're taught to call 911. But there's a growing recognition that the police aren't always the best suited to respond to something, especially when the emergency involves, say, an acute mental health crisis. We've seen catastrophes over and over again. In July of last year, LA County rolled out an alternative hotline for mental health emergencies, 988. The program was heralded by Karen Bass and other local leaders as a revolution in crisis response, but a recent LA Times investigation tells a different story. Extremely long wait times, bureaucratic rigmarole have hobbled the program and left many without help when they need it the most. Well, journalist Lila Seidman writes about mental health for the Times and led the investigation into the hotline's failures. Lila, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
I mean, sending trained mental health professionals out in the field, you know, to respond to crises it's not a new phenomenon. We've seen it over and over again. The LAPD, the LA Sheriff's Department, Department of Mental Health here in the county have been doing it since the early 90s. What's different, though, about the 988 program, this crisis hotline?
So the 988 hotline is a national hotline, but it's being rolled out in counties and individual jurisdictions. And when it arrived and finally went live in mid-July, Los Angeles County officials said a large component of this hotline service is going to be these in-person mental health clinician teams.
These are the crisis teams that go out, right? When someone punches 988, I need your help, or we need your help.
Exactly. So that's how it's supposed to work, right? It's supposed to be like you would call the hotline or call the Department of Mental Health and be able to access these teams that, similar to a patrol or an ambulance, would go out and tend to you.
And what this crisis team is supposed to do, right, if there are enough of them, and that's something that we'll get into in just a moment, but what they're supposed to do is sort of allay the, you know, this is a law enforcement issue. If somebody's having a mental health crisis, that, you know, they don't get shot or they don't, you know, this can be de-escalated.
Yeah, that's exactly how it's been pitched, as sort of an alternative response to police. And so over and over again, officials have said, we need a different type of response. And this program, as you mentioned, has existed for a long time. But in recent years, there's been a lot more energy around empowering this alternative to police as people see how the current system isn't working that well.
In your reporting, Lila, you say that for about a third of the calls to the hotline, it's taking 8 hours or more for a team to respond. 8 hours when you call someone. If somebody's having a mental health crisis, if there's something maybe even violent happening, 8 hours is a disaster.
I think that was the most shocking revelation from the investigation. I had heard people anecdotally tell me that they were waiting hours, and that is what prompted me to look into this. And the data reflects that. And yeah, it shows, as you mentioned, in 2022, 34% of requested teams were taking more than 8 hours.
Yeah, more than a third. So where do people wind up turning instead? Like if you feel like you're not going to be answered or someone's not going to come for hours and hours, do you just wind up calling the police again, 911?
That is a strong possibility, you know, that it basically creates a vacuum where people might try this service. And I've spoken to people who have said, you know, I used to try to call and get these unarmed teams out, but it was taking forever, or they would simply not respond. So what choice did I have except to call 911? And at least in that case, you will most likely get some type of response.
988 as you mentioned, Lila, is across the country. It was rolled out across the country, but there are only specific counties that have the tools or are able to have the tools to be able to really utilize it in an important way.
Yeah, it's actually pretty rare for a county to have a robust mental health crisis team system to be able to send out these teams. And so LA County, in a way, has been on the forefront of that. It's just that they've really struggled to get the program up and running to a point where they're able to respond efficiently.
So the LA County Department of Mental Health has 35 crisis response teams that are up and running right now. Are they bringing more online? Because there's research that shows they need way more than that.
Right now, the county mental health department told me their goal is to get up to 60 by the end of the year. They told me they believe that that will allow them to have 24/7 service, because right now, one of the biggest problems is it's not 24/7. It runs from 8 a.m. to 2 a.m. So as we know, crises do happen between 2 a.m. and 8 a.m. So that is something that the county is really says is their priority, because, you know, again, as we know, crises do happen during that time.
And what does the county say? Will there be enough, do they think, going forward?
They said that 60 should be enough to get to 24/7 and reduce those wait times. I mean, it would be a significant improvement in terms of just the number of teams, right? That would be almost double of what we have now. A consultant that was brought on to look at the county's needs estimated that they would need 138 teams within the next few years, 3 to 5 years. So it's a little bit hard to say, in that I feel like they're so below their target that it's hard to know what's going to happen once they actually scale up, if they're able to scale up.
Right. And there are so many, you know, elements that are involved in that, right? Money and human power, right? To be able to get the people to hire people to do, you know, be a part of those teams.
Yeah, but the strange part of this is that they're saying it's not a financial issue, that they actually have money to support these teams. But despite that, they're not able to hire people, because during the pandemic, a lot of people stopped wanting to go out and do field work. They transitioned to telehealth. So that's what the county is saying, that, look, we have this money, but it still hasn't worked. And now they're exploring creative ways to get people on board.
So it's a matter of incentives, right? It's a matter of getting people hired, not necessarily about the money.
According to the county, it isn't due to having not enough money. They're saying they have enough money, but they haven't been able to attract people to do this work, and that they're exploring ways in which to bring people on, including, you know, offering them bonuses or certain types of flexible schedules.
Lila Seidman, journalist covering mental health for the LA Times. Lila, thanks for coming on and explaining it to us.
Thanks for having me on.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The book, The Written Word, transforms you to another place and time. It ignites the imagination. And with LA in full bloom, bibliophiles from around the world are converging on this city of angels to celebrate all the pages. For 27 years, the LA Times Festival of Books has been bringing literary luminaries to town, and this year's lineup is no exception. Best-selling authors and poets, musicians, actors, you name it. And Boris Kochka is the LA Times books editor, and Boris is with us right now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I know the festival looks pretty fantastic this year, more than 500 participating artists. Tell us about some of the folks you're excited to have in the lineup.
Well, yeah, we got quite a lineup this year. A lot of it really came together, and you know, the star power we've got, you know, in literary circles and otherwise, is pretty intense. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing Matthew Perry speak, you know, among the celebrity contingent. His memoir was very candid about his struggles during and after Friends, And, you know, hearing him talk live about that should be a really interesting experience. Laura Dern and her mother are going to be appearing together in a panel moderated by Mary McNamara, who's one of the great columnists here. And, you know, they have a book together, and they're going to talk about their relationship. Of course, Diane Ladd being Laura Dern's mother.
Yeah.
And how they've both navigated Hollywood separately and together. Max Greenfield, Judy Greer, Leslie Odom Jr., some of the more frequent guests we're having. The musical guests, I mean, you know, Joan Baez, Megan Trainor, and then there's V, the formerly known as Eve Ensler, the performer. Those are definitely people I'm looking forward to seeing, as well as, you know, among the writers, Viet Thanh Nguyen, Lynn Thompson, the poet, Otessa Moshfegh, talking to Rachel Kushner together.
I mean, my gosh, Boris, this is a crazy lineup.
My
goodness. No, that was great. I mean, seriously, when you talk, if I have to interrupt you because you're just going on too long about the people you're excited to see, I think that's a pretty good menu, right?
Yeah. I definitely think so. You know, my only regret is that I'll be a little too busy with everything to see most of the panels.
Yeah, you're sort of immersed in it, aren't you?
Yeah.
I know that y'all are going to be talking to James Ellroy this weekend on Saturday. Really made his career writing about L.A. For folks who haven't read any of his books, where do you suggest that they start?
I would say L.A. Confidential is the place to start. I mean, you have these characters who kind of represent all these different kinds of kind of pathology and police corruption. I mean, he's a very dark writer, but he's almost kind of stream of consciousness. And, you know, he's not exactly what you'd expect, a little bit in the Dashiell Hammett tradition, but, you know, it's easy to forget that he was actually writing in the 90s and 2000s. So it's a sort of flashy look back. Yeah, I would say start with L.A. Confidential, go through the L.A. Quartet, which is that book, and then three other ones, all set in the 50s and 60s, and gets into the heart of L.A.'s darkness.
What about another LA author at the festival, maybe that's not so well known, somebody that, you know, you think, oh, this is someone that you should absolutely read?
Well, I wouldn't say that Javier Zamora is unknown. You know, he's been winning prizes left and right, but his account of his migration as an unaccompanied 9-year-old from Central America through Arizona, it's harrowing, but it's also told in an interesting way in sort of retrospect. It sort of breaks ground in memoir, but in a way that really makes us think about the larger problems with immigration and also the culture shock that migrants go through. I definitely think he's someone to watch in the coming years.
The festival, of course, is free, but there are some things that you have to pay for, right?
Yeah, you know, there's a Friend of the Festival package, and that will just get you kind of all access. Those are selling at quite a clip, and that just kind of saves you the hassle of having to show up and maybe miss a reservation because a lot of the individual events are selling out. You have to pay $5 to reserve the individual events, and then $20 and possibly buy a book if you do our ideas exchanges, which are the bigger sort of Matthew Perry, Laura Dern kind of events. But, you know, you look around and compare it to other festivals. I would say it's the most accessible of them all.
Boris Kochka, LA Times books editor. Thanks, Boris, for coming on, talking with us again today. We appreciate it. Good luck with the festival.
Thanks for having me. It's going to be great.
And if you'd like more information, by the way, on the free programming, you can head on over to our website, kcrw.com/GLA. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, going green in LA means green bins now, too. That's for food waste. But how's it all going to work? Are you ready to start composting for the greater good? That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Tell us what's on your mind. Even share a story idea with us as well. And you can do that at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. And get the podcast as well. Wherever you get your podcasts, just search KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zeke Reed, Zoe Matthew, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Christine Camito, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together today. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. Of course, thanks for your ear. Have a great night.